It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Chris Potter, in for Kevin Gavin. Earlier this week, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman announced the appointment of Brandon Flood as Secretary of Pennsylvania's Board of Pardons. The board recommends to the governor whether someone convicted of a crime deserves a pardon or clemency. Mr. Flood, who served 9 years in prison on drug and gun offenses, received just such a pardon from Governor Tom Wolf before taking the job as board secretary. He joins us from Harrisburg. Mr. Flood, thanks for making time.
Absolutely, and thanks for having me.
Mr. Flood, you at one point were headed down a path that I don't think many people would guess would lead you here. As a young man in Harrisburg, you started selling pot, you moved on to crack cocaine, and at one point were shot 3 times. Felony charges led you to spend 9 years in prison. What turned your life around?
It would be disingenuous of me to say that certainly I was not on the cusp of that, the point of no return. But for me, it was a number of factors. Number one, I would say, is, and I'm plugging them real heavy these last few days, SCI Chester, which is one of the several dozen state correctional institutions in Pennsylvania. Their prison model is unique when juxtaposed against other state correctional institutions, especially those in rural areas. Temple University, Drexel University would come with some with great regularity. I would have debate classes, public speaking classes, writing classes. Also during my time there, served as the editor of the newsletter. And I really got to engage in personal development. And so that was one factor. And the secondary factor was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, the author of which is Alex Haley. That was the first time I ever had encountered a person who traveled down a similar road as I, was able to claw his way back up and really transform himself and reinvent himself. So that's when I gained an interest in politics. And I knew once I would be released, that's the field I wanted to pursue.
You did go on to a very successful life in Harrisburg, working on behalf of unions and civil rights groups. How did you kind of make that transition from I just walked out of jail to becoming a sort of respected figure within state politics?
Well, ironically, the intent was not to make a foray into state politics. My interest was more so local politics, city politics at the time. But, you know, luck would have it. I had a good friend of mine that remembered me and my family. He asked me what I planned on doing with myself. He had mentioned that there was an intern opportunity with the House of Representatives, specifically with the House Health and Human Services Committee. And from there, once I got in and learned how the sausage was made, there were opportunities for advancement, and I certainly took advantage of those.
At some point, you decided to go and seek this pardon. As somebody who sought one, talk a little bit about what that process was like.
Ironically, before I pursued clemency on my own behalf, I became interested in reforming the clemency process, especially during my time with the Legislative Black Caucus. So looking to instituting minimum eligibility requirements, automatic expungement, just addressing, like I said, some of those inefficiencies with the process. At the time, there was a huge backlog. I believe over 1,000 applications were in the queue. It wasn't even on my radar to pursue clemency for myself. The then secretary of the Board of Pardons, she had urged me. She had asked the question, begged the question, why was I not pursuing clemency? So I submitted an application. The first time I submitted it, there was a clerical error, and they actually sent it back, rejected it, and I had to start the process over. I wasn't going to reapply because it was a very rigorous process. So I let about a year go by before I did reapply. And, the rest is history.
Obviously, you had gotten your life back on track by that point. So I'm curious both how you felt about it and how somebody who didn't get kind of some of the breaks that you did, right, what that means for them to, after 2-3 years, to get themselves a pardon. How does that change your life?
Well, yeah, that was part of the reason why I didn't reapply initially, because I had felt that, hey, I've been able to make some significant inroads within state government despite these convictions. Most of the people who have or are just now trying to get their lives together, those collateral consequences for them are real, especially when it comes to employment. So for the average person, that they would relish the opportunity to push that reset button. And, following the announcement this week, I've been flooded with phone calls from folks who shared their stories and who've now said that they're inspired to even attempt to navigate the clemency process.
You mentioned automatic expungement a couple minutes ago, and I want to make sure we slow down and talk about that for just a second, because even when you get that pardon, those criminal charges are still there. Somebody wants to go and do a background check on you. That stuff still pops up, and it's a whole other process to go and get those charges removed. What, if anything, can be done about that? Because it would seem to me, I think, and to a lot of people, that once you're pardoned, that stuff should sort of go away. Otherwise, what's a pardon for?
Right. Correct. A pardon merely allows one who is not eligible due to convictions that extend beyond the summary conviction or non-conviction information. It merely allows you to become eligible for expungement. So it is two separate processes. The one thing that does happen when you get a pardon, so if someone does run a background check, especially if they do it through PSP as they're supposed to do, there is a notation that the individual did receive a pardon. However, those charges are still there. Most people don't go through with the actual expungement, because it sometimes can be cost prohibitive. And also that's just an additional step. So the pardon is supposed to be the ultimate act of clemency, total forgiveness from the Commonwealth. That should be all encompassing and should include expungement, in my opinion.
You've raised for me sort of the big question here as you begin your tenure as secretary here, what your kind of top priorities are. And which of those you can kind of do on your own without some sort of legislative action or without a court action? If you could just kind of break that down a little bit.
So I know some of the stuff is more so about access. I know the lieutenant governor wants to have some brick and mortar pardon consultation sites so folks can come in and be able to have some assistance in filling out those applications so they don't feel alone, or at least make it that less daunting for them. Administratively, we're trying to look at addressing some of the inefficiencies that bog down my staff. So even like minimum eligibility requirements is something that I've always been a fan of. Right now, anybody and everyone can submit an application for clemency. I can be convicted of murder tomorrow and submit one. So there's a lot of candidates that aren't necessarily ideal candidates whose candidacies don't rise to the level of where the board would actually probably render a favorable recommendation. So those are the folks that are actually causing that bottleneck, whereas there's tons of people that are ideal candidates. Those are the type of people that are slam dunk cases for pardons. And those are the folks that we want to make sure that they're applying and that we can at least get them a reasonable turnaround, as opposed to some folks that maybe need a little bit more time to get more accomplishments under their belt to kind of counterweight the negativity of their past. So our application process, too, we're looking to digitize that. We're still kind of operating in like the 18th century with a lot of paper-based applications. Addressing a lot of those efficiencies is my main objective.
It strikes me as you were talking that, as you say, a lot of this is about access and streamline the process. But ultimately, the board is making a recommendation to the governor here. It's not for the board to decide this. It's ultimately
Correct.
For the governor to do it. And while obviously Governor Wolf seems very open to your initiatives, not every governor will be. You know, governors who either want to look tough on crime or governors who are afraid that, you know, if they let somebody go, that person will go out and recommit an offense.
Those are certainly some legitimate concerns that you raise. But as you mentioned, too, I have no power or vote, you know, when it comes to these applications. So I've seen some write-ups where it made it seem as if I'm the final arbiter. But as you mentioned, we have five voting members, different backgrounds, different areas of expertise. They're looking at applications, whether the same application, but through different lenses. So you still have that stopgap. And then, as you said, you still have the governor.
And some of the inmates who you serve time with may still be incarcerated or haven't been pardoned yet. What do the rest of us need to know about them?
One of the things that was beneficial for me, too, a lot of the lifers forced me to engage in these classes and public speaking classes and debates and really forced me to kind of go outside of my comfort zone. So, you know, I'm the first to say there's some folks that don't deserve to be released and certainly should pay the penalty for being incarcerated. But there are a lot of folks that either weren't the trigger man or made a mistake, and certainly after several decades have atoned for their transgressions and probably could prove to be more of an asset to society than they could just occupying a bunk in a state correctional institution.
Brandon Flood was just appointed as secretary of Pennsylvania's Board of Pardons. Mr. Flood, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Like I said, definitely a pleasure, and look forward to getting some things rolling here. So once again, thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Chris Potter. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Gentrification is a word looming around most conversations about Pittsburgh's growing economy. Coming up, a panel of experts takes a look at how Pittsburgh went from worrying about who's leaving to worrying about who's coming in. Get more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Bernie Sanders will be in town this weekend. The Democratic presidential candidate will spend the weekend touring battleground regions, finishing with a rally in Oakland near the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon University campuses. And the oldest functioning set of Deegan Company tower chimes have been restored back to their original splendor. The set is located in Ford Chapel on the campus of Allegheny College in Meadville. Only 10 such chime sets still exist. Find more online at wesa.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Chris Potter. In December, a fire at a U.S. steel plant crippled its ability to control its air pollution. For 3 months, the Pittsburgh area was blanketed with releases of sulfur dioxide that were much higher than usual, and thousands reported suffering from poor air quality. Last week, the steelmaker finished repairing its pollution control equipment. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports that worries about air pollution and its health effects remain.
From her backyard on top of a hill, Doreen Luff can see the Clairton Coke Works and smell it.
And when the wind blows, it blows the sulfur up here pretty good.
Luff says since moving to the community of Jefferson Hills 12 years ago, she could always smell the plant, some days worse than others. But after the December 24th fire at the Clairton plant, things got worse. On warm days, she had to keep her windows closed. Her kids' schools stopped outdoor recess on bad air days. And in January, her 9-year-old daughter, Katie, started having problems breathing. Luff blames the plant.
She's never been sick like that before, but now she has asthma. She has to use an inhaler. I get nauseous. I have headaches constantly.
Luff has complained to the Allegheny County Health Department, and she's not alone.
It makes me feel like I want to throw up.
Especially after I get off my bike, I'm wheezing. I've never had any issues breathing. I feel like I have asthma now.
It feels like I have, at the same time, razor blades and feathers in my throat and in my lungs.
That's Corey Powell and Jacob Fleming of nearby Glassport, and Luff's neighbor, Rita Derrick. The county health department has received thousands of air quality complaints since December. According to logs of some of those complaints obtained from the agency, residents warn the county of things like a strong burning smell, bad air, headaches, coughs, and smoke filling the whole valley. Some reported they couldn't even take their pets outside. The air was so bad. The U.S. steel plant in Clairton is North America's largest producer of coke, a key component of steelmaking. To make coke, the plant bakes coal at high temperatures in hundreds of ovens. Jim Kelly, the health department's deputy director, says the pollutant most people are smelling is sulfur dioxide, which is produced when the plant's sulfur-rich coke oven gas is burned off in flares.
So it's a pretty acrid smell. And you know, obviously, you know, the problem with sulfur dioxide is in the presence of water, it forms sulfuric acid. So you can just imagine what that does when you breathe it into your lungs.
After the fire, U.S. Steel was emitting 5 times the amount of sulfur pollution as it's permitted for, Kelly said. Environmental groups and angry residents criticized the health department for not doing enough to protect air quality after the fire. But Kelly says the agency did what it could within the bounds of the law. He said the department couldn't just order the plant to close down while it fixed those controls because he didn't think a judge would allow it. That's because coke ovens need to stay hot or else they break down.
And to replace a coke oven is about $500 million. And so that's something a judge will take into consideration if we order them to cease operation.
In February, the county tried to order U.S. Steel to put the plant on a hot idle, where the plant stays hot but produces no coke. But the agency backed down when it learned that U.S. Steel said it would have taken longer to put the plant on idle than to just repair its pollution controls. To spread its sulfur emissions over a greater area, U.S. Steel has been flaring its coke oven gases at different locations. One of them overlooks the town of Glassport. Outside the Dollar Tree there where she works, Jennifer Magura says the air was so bad she got bronchitis this winter.
And I have a rescue inhaler and I've been using it like nonstop. You know, I mean, I already emptied two in the last 2 weeks. And it's just hard to breathe, it's hard to walk because it's draining all my energy.
Magura is a smoker, but she says the kinds of breathing problems she's had this winter are different.
I mean, I've smoked all my life, so I know what that's like, and I know when things are worse than usual. Because when I go, like, downtown Pittsburgh, I'm not struggling as much to breathe, and that's, like, in the same day.
But some aren't so bothered by the plant's air pollution, so long as it's providing jobs. Hilda Lukert of Clairton said she couldn't really smell anything different in the air. She's lived in Clairton all her life, and her son works at the plant.
Well, everything needs to be cleaned up. You know, I mean, they do have to follow, they should follow guidelines. But as long as there's smoke coming out of there, I know men's going to have their job. So, I mean, I don't have any complaints about it.
1,200 people work at the Clairton plant, which supports another 1,800 jobs at two other U.S. steel mills nearby. Lukert remembers the days when the air was so bad in Clairton, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. The plant is much cleaner than in those days, she says. And U.S. Steel says it's spending $65 million to clean the plant up.
Give them a chance to work on it. If they, you know, instead of shutting everything down and having all these men out of a job, you know, give them a chance to improve it.
Back at her home in Jefferson Hills, Doreen Love says she's thought about moving, but she doesn't think her family can afford it right now. Her husband works for Verizon, and she's a stay-at-home mom.
I talked about moving, but I think we're financially unable to. So we're kind of stuck here like a lot of people are.
Her 9-year-old daughter Katie says on some days she's tried to hold her breath when she goes outside to wait for the bus.
And I'm not really good at holding my breath. So I don't really, and I kind of smell like sulfur. I don't like that. I don't like it a lot. I don't like it at all.
Luff is glad the mill has put the pollution controls back on, but she says some days the air is still unbearable. She hopes her headaches go away and that her daughter's breathing gets better eventually. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
I'm Chris Potter. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Chris Potter. Since 1948, Jones Printing has designed, crafted, and manufactured products for companies throughout Allegheny County. The Homewood-based brick-and-mortar business faces challenges in an industry increasingly going online. For our series, Built in PGH, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports.
Surrounded by stacks of paper, ink containers, and cardboard boxes, Denise Jones taps the top of a gray metal machine.
This is our cutter, one of them. This is an electric cutter.
Beside her, a printing press whirs and shiny cylindrical instruments inside spin. Joan says this 15-year-old machine processes any paper product.
Envelopes, letterheads, business cards, cardstock, big envelopes, big paper.
Jones operates this press almost every day. Stickers for a local company are scattered around her and piles of brushes lay near a paint-splattered sink behind her. There are some colorful mugs with business logos next to lots and lots of cardboard boxes. The building itself isn't huge. It's no warehouse. Rather, it's divided into several small offices and a long printing room. As co-owner of the shop, Jones has gotten used to the hums and drones of the printer, so much so that she can repair it whenever it glitches.
It's been so expensive to get our machinery fixed that we've basically learned how to fix it ourselves.
71 years ago, Jones's father started the printing business. She says he learned about the trade during his time in the Air Force. Jones attended now-closed Connolly Technical Institute, where she learned how to operate the presses. The Homewood location is the third move for the shop. They're next to two other longtime family-owned businesses, Strong's Cleaners and Dorsey's Record Shop. B. Being in this community has been a challenge, she said, because it's not always had the best outside reputation.
It's been a struggle. Yeah, it's been a struggle. Just staying in business, I guess. Let alone staying in business in Homewood.
Jones and her business partner, Brittie Clay, are both African-American women in an industry that's dominated by white men. Jones says over the years, that's made it difficult for them to be taken seriously. When Jones or Clay answer the phone, callers often ask to speak to a man.
It's rough. It's rough. It's definitely rough being a woman, period, because you don't get the same respect that a man would get. And being a black woman is just as bad. So it's been rough.
Plus, in the years Clay has helped operate the company, the internet was born.
The internet, it's taken us for a run.
Online companies like Vistaprint and Zazzle market their services to consumers who can print business cards or custom mugs from their couch, rather than set up an appointment with a brick-and-mortar business. Jones says it's been a tough adjustment, but thanks to Clay's technological savvy, they've stayed relevant.
Because she knows the computers and the digital printing and all the new upcoming stuff. She knows all of that.
And that's not deterred Jones and Clay. Together, the two cater to a diverse size and type of clientele.
Mainly churches, some corporations like Alcosan, Port Authority, American Best Furniture, and repeated customers from clubs and organizations.
These repeat customers trust the expertise of Jones's business, she says, and they appreciate the convenience.
We're a one-stop print shop. You come here, you don't have to go no further. We can design it, we can print it, and we can deliver it.
Jones Printing has transformed itself along with the city of Pittsburgh. It's gone through physical moves and industry changes, and the women behind it are still ready as ever to customize a banner or flyer for local customers. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Chris Potter. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Chris Potter, in for Kevin Gavin. It wasn't too long ago that Pittsburgh worried about all the people who were leaving here. Nowadays, we're more likely to worry about the people who arrive. Fears of gentrification, the displacement of long-term residents by wealthier newcomers, are the dark lining to every silver cloud about the region's economy. Last month, a study by the National Community Reinvestment Coalition reported that Pittsburgh was one of the fastest gentrifying cities in the country. What does that trend look like, and what will Pittsburgh look like in the years ahead? I'm joined by three people here in the studio who look at these questions from different angles. Chris Bream is a regional economist at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Social and Urban Research. Kate Giamarisi is a reporter covering lower-income communities and change at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And Carl Redwood is an activist and community organizer at the Hill District Consensus Group. Thanks, all of you, for being here.
Morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Chris, let's start with you and with this study, which ranks Pittsburgh as really one of the few non-coastal cities that ranks in the top 10 for gentrification. What's driving these kinds of numbers? What does that kind of information tell us about where this city is?
Well, I think, you can look at the city and say, gee, it looks like population has stopped declining over a long time. But I think the key point is that there's tremendous change in the population within the city of Pittsburgh. And the city of Pittsburgh is certainly only part of the county and the region. So even though there's some stabilization, there's tremendous decline in the African-American population. I think there may be stabilization in sort of the white population. And then we've sort of seen a growth in a student population, which has created sort of a large growth of either immigrants or Asian-Americans. So there's a lot of change going on, even though it may not look at it from that top line number.
And Carl, I'm guessing that when you hear about a report like this, it doesn't surprise you much. Try to put a face on these numbers. What do these kind of processes, these dynamics that Chris is talking about, what do they look like in a community like the Hill District, in a city like Pittsburgh?
I think it's important to note that we've lost a quarter of the black population from the city of Pittsburgh, mainly to the suburbs. When people get pushed out, they're moving to Penn Hills, way out Penn Hills. They're moving to Braddock. They're moving to places where rents are cheaper. The real issue is the rents are too high and the wages are too low. So people can't afford to purchase or to live here in the city of Pittsburgh. We're losing three black people every day from the city of Pittsburgh to the suburbs.
Wow. And Kate, you cover low-income communities here in the city. I'm curious, these are places where people can't necessarily afford the rents when they start to go up. When you're in those communities, when you're talking to those residents, how much anxiety do you detect from the residents, from the civic groups that try to represent them?
Well, it's definitely a concern I hear about a lot, and I definitely even hear about it from people who live in neighborhoods that most people would not really think of as gentrifying or maybe even at risk of gentrifying, but it's definitely a concern for a lot of folks that I speak to.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in this because when you talk to Mayor Bill Peduto about this, about concerns about gentrification, he always says something along the lines of, look, there's not one real estate market in Pittsburgh. There's 90 different real estate markets, some in neighborhoods that are really hot, some that are kind of stone cold here. So, but it sounds like you're saying people don't necessarily see that within their own lives. There's still these fears there. Where is that coming from?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that the mayor is wrong because we do have, you know, uneven development here in the city. But just, I mean, I'm thinking in particular of affordable housing meeting I was at several years ago and speaking with a woman who lived in California Kirkbride, which is a neighborhood, the north side, that's a pretty high poverty neighborhood. And most people would not really think of as at risk for gentrification, but she flat out said, she said, I don't want my neighborhood to be the next East Liberty, and I'm very concerned about that.
Mm. Chris, I was kind of kidding about this before, but it is in your memory and mine, 20 years ago, people really did worry that the city was just going to be depopulated. And I'm wondering, was there an inflection point? Was there something that turned the course of this region around? And what demographically, expand on this idea that you were talking about, this sort of dynamics within the city in terms of the demographic makeup.
I can't pass up an opportunity to mention Border Guard Bob and our efforts to sort of keep young people in the region, which was really a regional construct. Again, Carl had it right. What's going on here in the city is a lot of displacement from the city into the suburbs, and the change in the city is directly impacting all of the near suburbs, especially the eastern and southeastern suburbs around here. And it's accelerating. I think, the African-American population is declining at an ever faster rate. And there's a lot of interest now in sort of helping folks move to neighborhoods of opportunity to help them sort of move out of poverty. We're certainly not moving toward that goal at this moment. I mean, if anything, we're moving the other way.
Yeah, Carl, talk about that, because I think a lot of times we have these discussions about what Pittsburgh, the city proper, is losing. But as you said before, and as Chris said just now, there are communities outside of Pittsburgh, your Penn Hills, your East Pittsburghers, where the population is changing dramatically. What's happening in those communities just outside the city? What challenges are they facing? What benefits are they getting from folks moving
well,
in?
Well, just real quickly, one of the things we recently dealt with was the murder of Antoine Rose in East Pittsburgh. East Pittsburgh's now a predominantly black neighborhood. Now, most people's thinking about East Pittsburgh was not that in the past. There's always been black people that lived in the small municipalities around Pittsburgh, but now the many communities like Homestead and East Pittsburgh are majority black. That's something we have to deal with. The other big thing, though, is that we have all these words like opportunity zone and all these new kind of new language, housing choice, all that kind of stuff. That's flim-flam. It's not real. We use words to say we're doing something, but the situation keeps getting worse and worse and worse. There is no housing market, I don't care how many there are in Pittsburgh, that's a good housing market for black people.
Hmm. I want to build on this idea. When folks move to these communities, the government structures that are there, there's an established political power structure in a place like East Pittsburgh. How quickly are those communities sort of adjusting to this new population and its needs and the things that it expects from government?
Well, in East Pittsburgh, the police department's gone. That's a change, and that happened because it's a predominantly black neighborhood now, and they didn't know how to handle it and deal with it.
Kate, I want to turn to you and ask this question. Carl's saying there's just really not a great solution here. Clearly, city officials are aware of this. Talk a little bit, if you could, about what they're doing and how far along on this process we are in terms of addressing the issue.
Well, so definitely as it pertains to housing, there's a couple things that have happened recently. So one was several years ago, the city convened this affordable housing task force that made some recommendations. And the big thing that's happened there is there was a $10 million annual fund created to preserve existing affordable housing and sort of bolster our supply of affordable housing, because there's, you know, according to the task force report, there's not enough. So that's underway. And there's also been some efforts recently to do what's called inclusionary zoning in the neighborhood of Lawrenceville. And that was actually before the city's planning commission this week. And that would basically require 10%, I believe, of the units in any development of 20 units or more, 10% would have to be affordable. Now, that would only apply to Lawrenceville. and it has yet to be approved. But that's another inclusionary zoning was also something that was recommended by the task force as a way to keep neighborhoods have a diverse set of housing options.
You are listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Chris Potter in for Kevin Gavin. We're talking about the changing face of Pittsburgh, forces of gentrification driving change within the city, who lives here, who's coming here, who can no longer afford to be here. And Carl, let me jump back to you here. Kate was just describing some of these policies here. I'm curious, is the concern that these policies aren't good policies, or they just haven't been taken far enough, they haven't been developed enough? Are we on the right track and we're just not far enough down, or are we completely heading in the wrong direction here?
Yeah, I won't jump on it exactly all the way, but we're headed in the right direction, but it's such a small step it won't make any difference. I mean, that's the real issue. The policies that have been put forward are still ways to get public money into the pockets of the developers and the banks. We would do much better if we just paid people's rent. If we'd use the $10 million to pay people's rent, we could get lots of months of rent for families. But instead, we're going to do the same policy as before, subsidizing developers.
And this $10 million you're referring to is money that the Affordable Housing Fund is supposed to have to use and figure out how to use it. What would, if they put you in charge of dealing with these issues in the city, what beyond sort of subsidizing rents directly that way, what else would you do?
The other thing that we need to look at, the Chicago Low Income Housing Trust Fund. There they focus all their efforts at families that are at 30% median income and below, and they pay landlords 3 months in advance if they agree to rent to very extremely low income families. That's the one thing we could do that would help relieve it more than anything else, because very low income families can't find places to rent. They end up renting up, and that pushes people in higher income levels. It makes it more scarce for people at 80% median income. But we need to focus on the people at 30% median income and below, extremely low income families.
Chris, as an economist, I'm interested when you hear solutions like that. Are these even problems that can be solved by public policy, or they're just broader messianic forces just driving this stuff in an economic or demographic thing? What do you think?
Well, I mean, this issue of maybe we talked about Lawrenceville. We usually talk about East Liberty. I mean, look, barn meet door. You know, I mean, I mean, the efforts to really have we're so far past the point in East Liberty. There are very few young black men left at all in East Liberty. Lawrenceville has gone through this tremendous change already. If you really wanted to avert these changes, it's something that would have had to put in place 20 years ago. We really need to think about the next 20 years and some of the neighborhoods that are on the cusp of these changes if we really want to have hope of sort of impacting policy-wise.
And what would those be? In case there are any real estate speculators listening wanting to know what problems.
Well, I wish to know. We've already mentioned some of them, the inclusionary zoning. I mean, I think the land bank here in the city has, I mean, the more fundamental restructuring of the labor of the real estate market is had a hard time getting off the ground, I think. I mean, to have an impactful land bank here. I think a lot of the real estate that we've seen, people always say, gee, I see all these big new apartment buildings going on that are fairly high-end. Who's living in them? Well, they're all, that's just it. They're all fairly large, fairly high-end. You know, I think that you can certainly induce other types of housing by zoning and tax policy.
You actually raised something I wanted to ask you, which is, I think in everybody's mind, when we think about, we're all imagining these like college-educated, hipster Google employees coming and driving everybody out. Is that what's going on here? Is it this influx of people that are, of tech workers that are sort of driving the old Pittsburgh out, or is something more going on there?
Well, in some limited cases, I think that's certainly true. But I think there was, personally, I think there was sort of a latent market for some high-end housing here in the region. So what you've seen, these developers, they're not out there to not make money, the double negative. I mean, so they've been pulling folks in that were maybe forced into housing they didn't want elsewhere in the neighborhoods. And I think you're seeing some other shifts in the real estate market beyond these issues we're talking about here. So I don't think it's all net new people to the city, and people need to think about that. That's why the city is not growing in any sort of inordinate rate. You know, I mean, again, the tremendous loss of the African-American population is offsetting, you know, any potential gains by most everyone else. So
So, Kate, talk a little bit, if you could, this notion that it's too late for East Liberty, it's too late for Lawrenceville, but some of these other communities might still have a shot here. That requires sort of a level of thinking ahead that we don't always do so great. So talk a little bit about that.
I mean, I think one place where you've maybe seen that recently is folks in Bloomfield feel like they want to try to have a say or have some control over development that might happen at one of the sort of larger remaining parcels in the neighborhood. So I think that's why you've seen that neighborhood being pretty proactive to try to get ahead of big luxury development. And that's something that I think residents in that neighborhood have been pretty vocal about.
And how is that working? Do you get a sense that developers, city officials are responding well to that kind of stuff, or is there still kind of a resistance to it?
Well, I guess we'll see.
I think the broader question here is, we talk about this stuff a lot. Have we seen any kind of change in mindsets when it comes to the decision makers who will decide the future of these communities? Carl, do you get a sense of that?
Yeah, I think bottom line, we can't solve the problem, a housing problem, at the local level or the regional level. It's a federal problem. It's actually a global problem. And we really have to look at it in a new light, because we can't solve it from where we sit. We need to change federal policy. We need public housing. We need social housing like they have in Vienna, Austria, where rich people are trying to get into public housing. There are examples around the world that can work and can be used, but we limit ourselves to small examples here. I'm not saying don't try community land trusts and limited equity co-ops. Those are all good things to do, but they won't solve the problem.
I want to ask you too, Carl, because I think a lot of times in America, where we have this strong free market ethos, there's a sense of, hey, look, communities are affordable, then they're not affordable. It's just the free market at work. It's unfortunate if some people get displaced, but that's the genius of capitalism. For those who don't live in the Hill District or didn't live in East Liberty 10 years ago, 20 years ago, what does the city lose? What do the rest of us lose when folks get moved out of those communities and they change?
I mean, there's so much talent that's been here. All the workers that built this city are the ones that are being displaced at this point. So it's the bulk, particularly of the Black working class, but also all working class folks are at risk of being pushed out of the city. And then it's just harder for them to get back to work or whatever. You know, there's no transportation. You're not close to your doctors anymore. I mean, there's a downside to being out there, and the loss is the city's loss.
Yeah, Chris, I know there's an issue with sort of service workers having to come a long way into the city from far-flung communities. As an economist, is there sort of a drag on the economy when we have that kind of displacement?
Well, look, workforce will become an ever bigger issue as labor markets everywhere tighten. And I think you see people being pulled in the workforce. I think, you know, past transit cuts here in Pittsburgh have had tremendous impacts on especially some of the communities that people moved to. People wanted to move up and move to Penn Hills. That was a community that suffered a lot from the last round of major Port Authority cuts. So I think these issues, again, will only get worse. They may not be getting better.
Well, we've got about 1 minute left, so I'm going to ask all of you to make a sort of a prediction here. 20 years ago, we couldn't have seen any of this discussion happening. What do you think Pittsburgh looks like 20 years from now, based on current trends? And we'll start with you, Kate.
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't really like to make predictions, but I will just sort of add to one of Carl's earlier points just about the federal issue here, which we didn't really talk about. But yeah, some of these housing things are the results of federal policies surrounding public housing and disinvestment in public housing going back for many years. So that's where I'll leave it.
Thanks for punting my helmet question there. Chris Bream, you want to take a whack at this? What are we looking at?
20 years is rough. I mean, 10 years out. I mean, look, I think, like I said, we're on a path right now that I think will only accelerate over the next 10 years. That's it.
And Carl, what do you think?
I think things will continue to get worse. There will be a battle at the federal level on whether we move towards a socialist type system or stay under capitalism. And that's going to be what determines the end of this.
And on that chipper note, we're going to have to wrap it up here. Our guests here today, Kate Giammarisi, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Chris Bream, economist with the University of Pittsburgh, and community activist and organizer Carl Redwood. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
For today, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, the fast attack submarine, the USS Pittsburgh, recently completed its final deployment ahead of a scheduled decommissioning. Tune in Monday for a conversation with its final commander, Pittsburgh native Jason Deichler, about that honor and the special relationship between the crew, the sub, and its namesake. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistants by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Julia Zankovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Her Royal Highness Megan Harris. I'm Chris Potter. To the relief of everyone involved, Kevin Gavin will be back with you on Monday. Have a good weekend of great news.